The following is intended for mature audiences only. Discretion is advised.
Thank you so much for downloading this episode of So What Do You Really Do? The podcast where I, your host, Deader Dennis Maller, talks to artists and entertainers about their day jobs. And the artist and entertainer on the podcast today is an actual artist, like graphic visual illustrator, Kelly Phillips. Kelly Phillips is a cartoonist and illustrator in Philadelphia that I met in Boston. I almost said here in Boston when I'm not in Boston. If you're a regular watcher, listener of the podcast, you know that I'm out of the house. I'm not in my podcast studio. I'm in a weird blank bluish void in Baltimore. I'm still doing episodes from Baltimore. I'll be back in Boston soon and we'll see how that works out. But I met her when I was in Boston a couple months back at the Massachusetts Independent Comic Book Expo, MICE. You may remember previous guest, Ellie Earhart, also was an artist at MICE that I saw. She was on the podcast. She drew portraits of my dog, who is named Sister. I met Kelly there as well because I walked right past her booth and just saw a book about Weird Al, the illustrated book of Weird Al, and a book, Weird Al and Me. And I was like, excuse me, what is this Weird Al thing? She is a illustrator that was invited to illustrate one of Weird Al's songs into a book that he made. And she has a history with him. We talk about all of that in the podcast and, of course, her history as an artist as well. It was nice to have her on. I say it in the podcast, I'm going to tell you now in the intro, you're going to hear it again in the podcast where I talk about I wanted to read her book and then left it in Baltimore when I went traveling and forgot. And I was like, you know what? I don't want to wait around. I want to talk to her. So I'm glad we got this podcast. She's a super interesting person. Very well-spoken too. Great podcast guest. She's one of those people. Not that my past guests weren't great. I had a lot of great ones. There are some bad ones. I'm not going to tell you who the bad ones were. Brad Sherwood. Anyway, but he, from Whose Lies It Anyway, but he wasn't a podcast. He was a written interview. Anyway, point being, she has a very interesting past and we talk about how she got into comics and to art, and how she became a fan of Weird Al and her experience with that. And it was a good, fun conversation. So I know you're going to enjoy it. Let's get right into the episode. You know what? Here's the thing. Let's break the walls down. For those who are new listeners, thank you for being here. Please, after the podcast is done or before it's over with, feel free to like, leave a comment on whatever podcast aggregator that you're listening to this on, whether it's on YouTube, on Big Comedies Network's YouTube, or if it's on Spotify, iTunes, iHeart, whatever method you're listening to the podcast, the new Google podcast, which I think called YouTube podcast, whatever it is. If you're listening, leave a comment if you like what you heard today. Reason I say that is because it does help the artists on the show. The more interaction people have with comments, liking, starring, subscribing, reviews, and stuff like that, the more the algorithm, which I go on too much about in this episode, and it rules too much of my day, but and my life, but it actually will put that more, the more popular things are, the more popular the algorithm makes them. That's just the way it works out. I hate it, but that's just it. The iTunes recommendation engine is not recommending things. It's going, oh, this seems to be popular with other people. Let's make it more popular with other people. So if you want somebody that you came here to listen to be more discovered by people and have a broader range of audience, like, comment, subscribe, tell a friend. All of that costs you nothing to do. And it helps so many people in so many ways, including me. And if you're here just listening, just like, hey, how do I not help Dennis? Well, then do nothing. But why are you here in the first place? People who want to just listen to my podcast and they complain about it and that not act like they listen to it. But anyway, it was a really good interest podcast. I love people that want to have a discussion about the things they do, that want to talk about getting into the depths of the pitfalls of their industry. So it was a really good conversation, and I hope you enjoy my conversation with comic book illustrator Kelly Phillips. Make sure that everything's ready before we
now do it. Do your checklist, whatever you got to do.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing: I'm on the road. This is not my home. I live in Boston. That's where we met. I met you at MICE very briefly, walking around. And trust me, I know you're not going to remember me unless I tell you I was the one person with a dog. Then you're like, oh, you, yes.
I do remember the dog.
Yes, everyone remembers the cute dog, my dog who is named Sister, and nobody remembers me. I literally have walked my dog around my own neighborhood, and people woke up, and they're like, oh, my God, Sister. I'm like, oh, so are you walking Sister today? I'm like, it's my dog. Why do you not remember my face?
It's because you have a dog. Dog yes. equals face.
Yeah. Well, in their defense, I have neighbors whose dogs' names I know, and I don't know their names. So,
oh yeah,
can't judge. Yeah,
nope, we can't judge that.
So I live in Boston. I have some time off from work. I have 3 months off from work, and I decided to go on the road, traveling and stuff. And here's the thing: when I bought your book and I was talking to you at the table, I'm like, "Oh, you're fascinating. This is a cool story. You're going to be on the podcast." In my head. Right? I don't want to show you all my cards at the moment. I'm like, I'll surprise her with a podcast.
You're like, request. Round two interaction.
But I wanted to actually read your book, you know, Weird Al and Me or Weird Me. This is why it's taken 4 months for me to reach out to you. Not because I'm a solo reader, because I left the book in Boston. So. Never actually, yeah. I got these 3 months off of work. I could sit down. I could read this really great anime or graphic novel of your life. And I left it 400 miles away and I never read it. So I was like,
it could have taken up an entire 45 minutes of your time.
Isn't that short? No, is it?
Well, the joke is always amongst cartoonists that you spend a year making something and people can read it in 10 minutes.
Okay. I could see that. I mean, it's a thick book. I got that and the... what was the thing? I wanted to read both that and the illustrated Weird Al, which you did some of the artwork for. And there was a point, when I was here, I had so much trouble remembering your name. I had to keep looking through it. And I knew it was Phillips because my brain does weird connections. So you are Kelly Phillips with two L's.
Yep.
There is a other artist in the book named Jesse Phillips with one
L.
And then the foreword of the Illustrated Al book is written by Emo Phillips, which is also a Phillips with one L. So yes. When I initially picked up all these books, there was some connection that my brain made between Phillips and Emo Phillips and Weird Al. And I was like, wait a second. Is it Emo Phillips' niece? Is she the webmaster for Weird Al? Is there a connection between this Phillips person and Weird Al and Emo Phillips? And is there a connection? Is that how they got? And I was just like, oh, no, it's Kelly Phillips. It's Kelly. It's the two L Phillips. How did I
mean, I'm also happy to leave the lore wide open to mystery.
We're here to get your life story and then create new alternative life.
Stop. If you're not creating lore in your life, what are you doing?
So, let's, because you are in Philadelphia. I'm in Baltimore, not quite halfway between Boston and where it is, but it's Philly to Boston is a good enough drive. What I really want to talk to you about is the convention scene, because that is a big part of comics right now. I interviewed another artist from Mice as well, who Aaron Earhart, who is an amazingly talented young lady. Who does great comics. And she actually, I saw her there, which was a meeting again because she was at a different garage sale or thing. And she drew a life portrait of my dog. Who is my yes. sister. And so we walked past and it was another one. She's behind the mask. I'm in the table. We all lock eyes. She looks out. She goes, sister.
Listen, the amount of people that you can see that you know well, your friends, and you see them after 3 years behind a mask for the first time, you're like, you're a whole new person. It's. Yeah.
I was at a bar trivia last night, which is not a thing I usually do, but I was hanging out with my buddy, and turns out another buddy of mine actually hosted that trivia that we went to that I didn't even know about. We were there, and one of the rounds was identify these celebrities by their eyes.
We should all be much better at it by now.
Could not do it. 3 years of a pandemic and looking at everybody from here up, could not identify Gwen Stefani or Julia Stiles.
No, you need the added context of a hairline or a silhouette. You need some other thing.
Yeah. The one I did get, David Schwimmer. Instantly nailed. I was like, David Schwimmer, friends, I got that. I am white. I got David Schwimmer from Friends.
It'd probably be an even better test of do that, but with your friends and family, and then really, really call out how little you pay attention to each other's faces.
or just people around the room with you right now. Like, oh, yeah. Crap. I have to identify them to their face.
And now you'll have to make like awkward sensual eye contact to really identify each other.
But the point I was like, oh, now you're noticing who has too many crow's feet for their age. So the convention scene, that's very important to artists right now. The convention scene is because that's the best place to be able to promote your work. You're actually in front of an audience that cares. Whereas internet and social media, you're just throwing things out into a void and hoping the almighty algorithm will bless you with sharing your life work in front of people. And as a stand-up comedian, trust me, there's no one who knows this more than I do. But
yeah,
you as somebody who has to go to these events, the conventions events, one, what was the impetus to start getting into showcasing at events? And also, can you tell people what it is like having the travel around? Like, just the financial responsibilities of, like, what's worth it? How much do you have to, like, covering table costs, travel, and stuff like that?
Yeah, there's a lot in there. But I would say, first, just how we got into doing tabling events. I would say that attending other comic shows is really what convinced me and my friends and the circle that I know that this was the way. This was the first way that you try to get yourself out in front of people, because it's very low barrier to entry. So long as you can just, you know, get through whatever it is that is the decision body that lets you into the show. And usually that's, you know, an accessible format.
I didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
You're like, well, so my similar thing is, in my days before a comedian, I was a manager for a bunch of local Baltimore punk bands. And one of the things I did, we had like a 3-month stretch where we didn't have any shows, couldn't book anything. And I was like, you know what we're going to do? We're going to go to the flea market with CD players and merch, and we're going to set up a table at the flea market. I'm going to give people headphones and let them listen to the band. You're going to be there. You're going to talk.
Yeah.
Make friends. We're going to set up a merch table at a flea market and make
friends. Gorilla flea market.
Punk rock. It's so punk rock, right?
DIY. I think a lot of people actually do that at comic shows too. Like if they're just wandering around, they don't have a table, they'll just come up to your table and be like, do you want my zine? Do you want my little mini comic? Do you want to trade? And then you can kind of just, you know, use the floor as your networking opportunity if you so choose.
But yeah, well, the barrier to entry at the flea market is just, I got $25 for a table. That's...
Yeah. And for some shows, you know, that's all you need to do. Yeah.
I never thought about that. For you, you have to, like, to get a table, you have to get approved. I just figured, like, when going to comic book conventions, there's Artist Alley, where are, like, the bigger name artists. And then there's just a whole nother section of people of, if you got $125, you got a table, you can sell whatever you want. I didn't think about it at a comics expo like that.
Yeah.
You have to get passed to get in.
Yeah, I would say most shows are actually what we consider juried. So you have to submit, you know, like samples of your work and a little blurb about what you do and you know, what's new and relevant and interesting about you. And then, you know, the powers that be make judgment calls on that. And they try to put together like the best representation of a comic show that they're looking to put on. And then others will do luck of the draw. You have kind of a lottery system. And then I think that's 10 times more nerve wracking and hope to not deal with that. I would rather kind of just like put myself out there and be like, all right, it's not what you're looking for. I probably wouldn't have my audience there anyway then. And we'll figure it out from there. But yeah, I think it was always part of the equation that as soon as me and my friends decided we were going to start making and publishing comics, that we would present them to people at comic events.
Okay. So you were always in it. Let's be honest. I'm going to tell you, I submit to comedy festivals all the time. I mean, that's what I think. And I have to judge. I'm at the point in my comedy career, where I have to judge whether it's worth the investment.
Yeah,
it's a $20 totally. Submission fee, but the travel. Like,
yes.
There's plenty of them that are big name comedians are there. They have an audience. There's going to be industry panels there where I can talk to bookers and stuff. And then there's ones where it's like, hey, we're doing a festival in nowhere, Texas. It's 2 hours from a major airport. And nobody whose name you've ever heard of is going to be here. I'm not submitting to that anymore.
Yeah, it's tough.
I don't need that stage time's not going to help me. Do you have a criteria of what goes into a comic convention or an exhibition like that or an expo that is like, this is worth my time or this is going to be the kind of audience that I make? What are those determining factors for you?
It's something that we think about a lot. And I keep saying we, because for the most part, when I table at one of these events, I'm doing it with my publishing partner, Claire Folkman, who does Dirty Diamonds with me.
Yes.
So we're each individual comics creators. And then we also have our extremely heavy book baby that we do together. So therefore we make all of these decisions together about, you know, which shows make the most sense, which ones we're interested in, all that good stuff. But I would say first and foremost, we try and look at what the target demographic is of that show. So I'll even do just, you know, very rudimentary delineations, like, is it an indie show? Is it more of a like nerd con, like a comic con, you know? Or is it like a library festival and it's more community based? And we can kind of make judgments from there about what kind of numbers we think we'll get back from being at that event. So you'll look at the cost of the table. How many days is it? Is it an audience that is new to you? Like, have you done this event before? Have you done it recently? And what kind of sales do you expect that you could do in that environment? So then there's also, of course, yeah, is it something I can drive to? Do I have a friend there whose couch I can sleep on? I've slept on many couches.
At 42, I'm still sleeping on couches. I might be sleeping on one right now.
I would say for the most part, we're lucky we've graduated to finding friends who have guest rooms. And I can actually have like a good night's sleep. But it's something we've also been thinking about recently as far as, you know, we're East Coast based. We've done tons and tons of East Coast, especially Northeast shows. And there's a little bit of, you know, saturation that I think can happen, especially when we've got, you know, these big published books that we're trying to, you know, keep fresh in the market for a long time. How do you start getting into new locations? So in the last year, we've actually been really experimenting with how do you get like hundreds of pounds of comics and display materials onto an airplane efficiently and not break the bank.
Again, so that's another thing that I keep forgetting about, because as a comedian, I mean, I have merch. My merch, like 2018, when I decided to do an East Coast tour that fell through, the merch that I purchased was coffee mugs. Now, most comedians have t-shirts. Do you know? Yeah. Coffee mugs not only are heavy and bulky,
breakable,
fragile. Yeah. So I had to do the same. The reason that I canceled that tour is because my car was not in the shape to be able to drive down the East Coast. And I couldn't bring enough coffee mugs to make a financial sense of it. So when I drive, like right now, I got a whole bag of the coffee mug sitting right over there. And I have not brought one to any single cop. I have not brought one to any comedy show.
I love a driving show because we can just load up the car with an aspirational amount of material. But as soon as we're getting on an airplane, I'm like, every ounce matters. Do I need 6 of these zines or do I need 8 of these zines? And am I going to sell them all? I don't want to bring them back with me.
I don't want to pay $30 for a checked bag.
Yes. And then it's like, am I going to get the free bags on Southwest and deal with that whole shit show? Or am I going to actually just spend the extra $100 and hope for the best?
Yeah. I mean, literally just did a festival in New Orleans that brought me down. Like, this wasn't submission. They're like, hey, we want you in the festival. I was like,
nice.
Thank you. Anyway, so
please pay for a hotel room.
The reason they wanted me to come down is because they wanted me to do a live podcast of this. And with that, I overdoing my expectations of what I should be doing. It was like, it should be a podcast. Bring a recorder, record audio. And I was like, I'm going to bring you a 3-camera setup. So it's like, there's literally, I made a TikTok jokingly trying to fit everything into a carry-on bag when I literally had to put everything into a carry-on bag. And I end up biting the bullet and just putting all my gear into a bag that got checked.
Ooh,
and then put my clothes.
Scary.
And then that's the other worry is like, if that bag gets lost.
Yeah.
Delta fucks me over.
Yeah. I've had that thought too, where it's like, maybe I should put a couple things in my carry-on, most of it in my checked bag.
Yeah, like maybe since the ukulele, Dennis, is not part of your comedy act, you can leave it at home, right? You don't need to bring that. That don't need to be your carry-on plus one bag. Maybe you should put everything in one bag and just carry.
Yeah.
This is my clothes and this is my camera equipment. No. Or Dennis, maybe you can ask someone to borrow a tripod instead of bringing your own 3 tripods. Have you ever tried to fit a tripod into a suitcase? It doesn't fit.
No. Yeah, and then there's also, we just did a show in Canada last year where we usually have friends who will also be tabling and they drive up and we just shove a bunch of our boxes into their trunk. We're like, no, we'll be good. We'll do the whole shipping setup that they have for us. So they at least have a drop zone in the U.S. They'll like freight all of it across the border and they worry about all the the customs nonsense that goes on. But it meant we had to plan in advance, like way, way, way in advance, what we were bringing. Can we fit it economically into these boxes? And then hopefully we don't have to bring them home, which was a mid-show question that we asked ourselves of, oh, these are now checked bags? But then there was the whole equation of, I forgot like half of my inventory. Just straight up didn't ship it or pack it. And I was like, yes, I remember what pile it's sitting in my studio right now. And it is not here with me in Canada. So it's like, well, we're just going to push the rest of it.
And the paper, not only do you have to worry about volume, you got to worry about the weight of these things too, because even if it fits in the thing, if it weighs too much, it gets sick. I was going to ask when you cross the border, because I know plenty of comedians have had this problem crossing the border into Canada of talking about, they got to be like, I'm here on vacation. I'm here just to hang out with friends, not tell them they're going to do comedy, you know, and then find, and same thing with my friends who are in bands had this problem more than comedians, especially with merch. They go to the back of that truck. All right, they go that they look around, they find that box full of money that you've been taking all your t-shirt sales with, and then like, oh, this belongs to the Royal Canadian Mounties now, this $4,000 worth of merch money that you just sold your entire life. So when did you
Canada loves American money.
What was the border what was the border like when you had to do that crossing? Because I gotta imagine you got an easier pass as an artist. I gotta imagine, I hope.
So the added fun of bringing comic books into Canada is there's apparently like a nationwide government perception that all comics equal porn. So
that might be the most Canadian thing. Hey, look, we don't want you bringing all your nudie drawings.
Like there might be nipples in there. So I've heard from plenty of other people that they've gotten like extra scrutiny when they say that like this is what they're doing, this is what they're bringing in, and everyone's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. So we've always kind of found ways to not necessarily declare all of our intentions. and we've fortunately also never been the people doing the actual like land crossing with the material. But we've had, you know, the people who would, you know, take a car up to the border with our stuff sitting in the back seat. They've definitely gotten stuck at the border for hours and hours, having to sit there and granularly declare every type of commodity that they've got, from like book to bookmark to postcard. And it's like, I can't wait for Canada to receive these dozens of dollars from all of us. But even bringing it on an airplane.
Loonies and toonies.
Yeah. Even bringing it on an airplane. I've got like a checked bag full of like 50 pounds of books, and they ask what I'm there for. And I'm like, it is surely for vacation. And that is it.
I know my suitcase is 50 pounds worth of magazines. I'm a fast reader.
And, you know, honestly, the real tip, I'm like saying illegal information right now, but the real tip is you present it as their promotional materials. And the show that puts this on will actually back you up and say, like, you know, we have bought this person and their services, and we're asking them to show up here. And these are all materials that we've already paid for. So they can't claim that these have any value that Canada can claim from you. And the show will graciously deal with all that nonsense for us.
At least they've figured that stuff out. Bless your hearts, Canada. You think all comic books are nudie mags and you want to take porn from people.
Yep.
But hey, you got your custom shit together. So thank you.
Yes,
you,
it is a secure.
You got figured out.
They are definitely getting the money from the people.
Well, let's rewind and go backwards and talk about why did you become a comic book artist? Let's talk about that first, and then we'll I'm dying about the Weird Al stuff. I'm teasing the Weird Al stuff to hold people through towards. We'll get to the Weird Al later because I'm excited, but I am curious about you as an artist, because you know I grew up in the 90s. You know, I'm 42. I was born in 81. I grew up in the heyday of Marvel and DC. You know, I started reading comics in the late 80s, just before Infinite Crisis, and then everything in the comic world blew up right after that. Like, I held in my hand an unopened copy that I paid money for of The Death of Superman. The
plastic
with the red blood symbol on it. Like,
I had a little like metal button that I wore in junior high that was just R.I.P. Superman from that comic, but it was because I hated Superman.
Oh, you weren't ironically? Of course a Philadelphia would be wearing a R.I.P. Superman.
The pettiest path ironically. Forward, please. Yes.
You don't have to say, I know, whatever. You seem to be close to my age when we talk about in reference and stuff like that. And obviously if involved with the Weird Al fan club, you have to be closer to my age. So
I am extremely aged by my book. Extremely. Being 13 at the turn of the millennium, yeah, that's like a finite point in the universe.
So where, like, I tried to draw, you know, artistic things, and I tried to go to Magnet High School for art, and it didn't work out. And I'm not really an artist. Never really was a kid, but that was a dream of mine. You were someone that followed through on it. What was the impetus to get you into art?
Yeah, I would say specifically with comics, I don't think there was ever a point in my life where I wasn't either reading or making or enjoying comics, because my parents are both nerds. They met okay. because they're nerds, and I was raised in a nerd household. So, like, my dad would read me and my brother comics as our bedtime stories. I remember being, like, 13 or 14 and ravenously reading every single issue of X-Men that my dad had collected from 1985 through 1996 in one summer. It was great and horrible, and is definitely why I stopped reading at 1996, aka Onslaught. But yeah, I was a big consumer of comics, and then eventually, you know, you start to get exposed to manga and anime and everything that's related in other, you know, worlds creating comics and graphic novels. And then, yeah,
we're actually polar opposites, because, I'm a man. Comics were supposed to be for me, but my father hated nerd stuff. He hated comic books. He never grew, like, he was born in 44. He was never into it. He hates sci-fi, all that stuff. And my first comic books I found were actually my mother's comic books that she somehow kept from, like, her old, from how, when she was a kid.
Yes.
I found them under her dresser somewhere. And thank God, out of all the things I can find, my parents' bedroom that they'd be hiding from me, thank God it was comic books.
Well, we all know that comics equal porn, therefore.
Yes, because of Canada, yes.
Yes.
But so in Baltimore, I'm reading Archie comics. I found, like,
yes.
some old Superman comics, like, that my mom had. And so my mom, not a nerd, not into the comics, she just had them from her childhood and kept them, and me and my brother just...
But it's also because, you know, from that era, comics were not automatically associated with superheroes. There were so many, they were like romance comics were the best-selling comics for decades. Yep. And then you, and that's where you get the offshoots of, like, comedy comics, like Archie, and that kind of covers all the bases. And I don't think it's until you get into, like, the 60s, 70s, 80s that superheroes really take over in a really dominant way.
Yeah, it was basically anything that was in the pulp movies got turned into comic books.
Totally.
So, like, yeah, in the early days of comic books, because they're like, whatever medium we have, we're going to tell these stories on. And so, yeah, it's interesting. I'm starting to lean on your girl in comics thing, because that is.
It is a true fact.
It is a true fact. No, women should. I definitely knew women who were in the comics growing up, but it was definitely also a boys' club growing up. And I understand where we're in a turn of a change in history where women are more into that stuff. And that's great. And it's wonderful. Growing up, did you feel that you weren't welcomed in the sphere of comics?
I was going, like,
to
say,
did you get into a fight on the playground going, first off, it's Wally West, not Barry Allen. Okay. Let me give you the straight dope on Flash.
I guess there is kind of a period in childhood where that doesn't matter. You know, like, when you're a little kid, you're just then, like, hanging out with the boys and you're hanging out with the other tomboys. And I was very aware that, like, me and my best friends were all tomboys.
Okay.
But it was because we liked, you know, like, Ninja Turtles and comic books and video games and like, playing outside. So there's, like, an element of your life where that doesn't matter. And then when you get into, like, you know, the pubescent era of your life where that suddenly starts to matter because your world suddenly becomes so much more gendered. I was going to say, when you were talking about, you know, growing up in an anti-nerd household, the trade-off is probably, like, I was sitting there enjoying reading all these comic books and you had friends.
So, no, I didn't. No.
But I was lucky enough that...
I still read comic books alone. Like, I was a nerdy kid. I was the first kid in my school, in my grade, to watch Monty Python. Did not make me popular.
But you grew up with the right parents, and they're like, "Boy, we're going to show you this. We're going to show you Spaceballs and Jurassic Park, and that's going to be culture for you."
That I gotta correct you again. No offense, they didn't show it to me. They just didn't monitor what I watched.
No, I would get sat down, and they'd be like, "Tonight, we're watching an important film called Alien." But yeah, no, I think I was lucky in like junior high, high school that I had a small circle of friends that were all into the same things that I was. And they were all girls, too, for the most part. So we would, you know, we'd be reading comics, we'd be making fan art, we'd be writing fanfic. Like we'd be in a very like self-congratulatory, supportive circle doing that. But also hyper aware that this was not like the norm of what we were observing around us. But I do think, you know, seeing how much more comics as a medium has been diversified across genres and across different creators and different, you know, like ways you can access them. I think more people at more ages and more types of people at all ages are into some kind of a comic. And that's no longer maybe the experience that people are having, which is great. That's what we want.
It's great that you had that experience where you felt comfortable in comics as opposed to other people that didn't have that experience, who felt uncomfortable, who felt like they were being pushed out, that it was, or I'm sorry to the people that wanted to get into it and then they couldn't because the boys club, it's literally the same kind of thing in stand-up comedy. We talk about a lot of how many women comedians left the business, left just a couple months in because they felt too unwelcomed at open mics.
Oh, totally.
I posted a TikTok the other day where I complained about why does every hypothetical scenario that you create that is not about a person, the subject of it has to be a woman that you're making fun of. Like, I'm not a woke dude, right? Like, I look like the reason for everyone's problems, okay? But at the same time, when your entire act is like, here's a observational joke about how this woman's a dumb broad, it's like,
it's like, oh, do you hate women?
You're so adorable.
No, I was just listening to a Why Won't You Date Me episode, the Nicole Byer podcast, and she had Kathy Griffin on, and they were just talking about that, where like even people who are friends with like extremely successful women comedians, they're like, oh yeah, when I'm thinking about just going to a comedy show, a woman isn't the first person to come to mind.
I've had women comedians on this podcast and have admitted they never saw a female comedian growing up. All their comedian idols were men. Meanwhile, me as a kid, again, not trying to be woke because I'm definitely not. All right. I've been in trouble for a lot of things that I say, but at the same time growing up, I wanted to grow up to be Lucille Ball. I didn't see a difference between her and me. I didn't see, it was like, oh, I can't be funny like her because she's a woman, or she's not funny because she's like, I definitely got into school fights on the playground going, Phyllis Diller is funny. Joan Rivers rules.
This is worth going to jail for. I highly support this kind of violence. And when it comes to, you know, what we were talking about with comics, too, that isn't to say that these spaces were always, again, are they intuitively open to women? It isn't like, are they pushing you out? But is it, are they creating an environment where you are naturally pulled in?
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the reasons that me and my friend Claire started publishing our own anthology of only women cartoonists, is because we saw a gap that we were like, why can't we buy this book that we're really interested in? And we just decided, okay, we'll just make it ourselves. So in a lot of ways, you still have to make these spaces in order to be able to get in. But I do think the reception, once you create it, it's like, oh, it's great. We've wanted you here all along. And you're like, yeah, could you have made this a little easier on me, please?
Could you help me? Could you help me up a little bit?
Yes. Can you not just see the aftermath and understand that, like, from the beginning, maybe there's people missing around you?
So growing up, you're a nerd. You started your own. Did you go to an art school? Like, what fundamentally made you an artist? Was it just doing it over and over? Because I also grew up with like Todd McFarlane doing like tutorials. Like, now it's all over TikTok, Instagram reels. You can watch your most famous comic artists just sit down and draw. They'll do tutorials and stuff. It was hard to find back then, but they were out there and I held on to them. Like, just by the, like, this is for me. Yeah.
Oh yeah, totally. And yeah, when I was like a teenager, I think I started to have an aspiration of, wouldn't it be awesome if I could just be a cartoonist, like be a comic book artist and draw X-Men comics. And that's well, when I would.
There was also a time where we watched Bob Ross unironically, and that's how we learned how to paint. Like, we literally, that was our only resource, was this weird guy with an afro.
They're like, he's showing us secrets. Like, this is how you make the trees happy. But yeah, no, I would like, you know, read these comics. There'd be ads in there for the Joe Kubert School of Cartooning. And I'd be like, oh, someday, this is what I'm going to do. This is how I'm going to learn how to do this. And, you know, as time goes on, you're like, that's not going to happen to me. So I'm just going to copy comics constantly and just like redraw all my favorite artists and kind of learn the ways that they draw. And that kind of, you know, makes you just want to play and have more fun. And it's like a very low stakes way to just be drawing for yourself and admiring art. And then, come college time, you know, I had to make some decision, right? So I decided to go to what I consider low stakes art school, which meant that it was like a not a BFA program, but just a more generalized BA program at a larger university. So that, number one, I didn't have to go to the BFA campus in the middle of the woods with a bunch of artists. That seemed a little too much for me.
Oh, you as a woman didn't want to go out into the middle of the woods with a bunch of mostly probably dudes. And
I think it was a good mix, but it was more the like, Is this the atmosphere I want to be in? And instead, I wanted to go to the bigger university and like get to take a whole bunch of other types of classes and meet different kinds of people, which ended up being the right decision. So I would say Temple University.
Okay, I had a friend who went to, my brother went. The reason I have a love for Philly is my brother went to Drexel. So I would go up there and hang out with him in an attempt to try and make us friends, and he wanted none of that. But I love the city. It's a lively city. It's great. It has people. I had a young lady who I graduated high school with. She went to Temple. I've met a couple other people that I got a love for Philly. I wish I went there more often. In fact, I keep trying to plan a comedy gig over there and just never really.
There's a ton of comedy locations here. Yeah. Tons and tons of theaters and stuff.
I'm just bad at planning. That's really what it is.
That is the ass ache of it, is you have to be like, oh, I have to do this. I have to get it started.
Well, if you give me, like, that's why I like doing festivals, because it's like, I have my dates already booked. I just got to get the travel done. Like, I don't have to.
Yeah.
Like,
just tell me where I got to be and I will get there.
The shows. Yeah.
Yep. I'll be there with bells on.
Somebody just give me the show. I'll show up. Like, that's, don't make me hunt down the shows.
Yes. But yeah, no, I would say, you know, as a teenager, I was really like comics, comics, comics. Then when college came around, I was like, I guess I should take this a little more seriously. And I was doing a lot of fine art in college. And I would say then by the time college was wrapping up, I was like, remember comics? Comics were fun and they involved storytelling. And I think that was an element of art making that I was missing a lot, is when you're in fine art, you know, the storytelling element can become a little obtuse, or if it's not something that resonates with the way that you like presenting art, then it's going to be a struggle. And I realized that, you know, comics and storytelling were way more for me. So serendipitously, what was happening around the same time is, so my friend Claire and I, who I do Dirty Diamonds with, we met in like seventh grade in cartooning club, which is, you know, very, very adorable. And then we went to different schools for college. She went to another.
Wait.
Yeah.
Please tell me she's blonde and you guys are Veronica and why am I forgetting her name from Archie? You're the duo of Betty and Veronica. That was her
name. Yes. No, she.
Are you a Betty and Veronica?
She was a dyed blonde for a little while,
nice.
But now we're becoming more and more similar. Where she's growing her hair out, and we're behind a mask, you could have a problem. but we both went to different art schools, and then by the time that was wrapping up, we were reconnecting with each other on LiveJournal, and we were both talking about all these comics we were seeing online, and that there was a show up in New York that we were really interested in going to together. So that meant that we reconnected. We were getting into indie comics at the same time. We were coming up with the same conclusion that there wasn't like the thing that we wanted to buy there and we should make it ourselves. And the rest is history. We've been doing that since then.
Well, how long, can I ask how long you guys have been working on this together?
Yeah, we started Dirty Diamonds in 2011. And I would say we were maybe starting to make comics the year or two before that. So it's been a minute.
No, that's great that you have that expertise together. So coming out of college, you have this degree in fine arts.
Oh, what do you do with it?
Right? Like,
yeah.
I had three college degrees. One in
radio production,
television production, and broadcast journalism. All right. And the reason I got all three is because there was a crossover, and half the classes crossover. So it was like, all I got to do is take a couple of extra months, and I got all three of them. I've collected the set, but it was a matter of what am I going to do with these things?
Exactly.
Luckily, while still in college, I got a job in radio, and I worked in radio for a bunch of years, and now I'm podcasting, because radio at the time in 2015, when I started this, iHeartRadio hated the word podcast. But so I knew what my path was. Like, my path was pretty clear.
Yeah, those degrees, at least to me, scream, you have a potential career in mind. My path was not so clear. And I would say that's the biggest criticism of art schools in general, is I don't think that they present to you a clear path towards career. Probably because they don't want to admit that you don't have to go to art school to get into art careers.
Yeah, there is that. Like, I'm sure you're working with somebody who figured out how to put a portfolio together, and here they are. Yeah.
It's like, you have talent, time, and determination. You can hack it, you know? So yeah, I think originally my goal was potentially going more of a graphic design route. And I spent a little bit of time trying to figure out how to do that and realized that that was certainly not something I was interested in putting more time and energy into.
Why?
So
why was that not for you?
I think because when I was hunting at the time, I'm not sure that companies really understood what they were needing out of graphic designers. I would say maybe I would have a different experience now, but back then they really wanted you to be the entirety of the package. They wanted you to be the designer and the developer. And that was just a little too much math for me.
In the early 2000s, we were, that's that weird period where it's pre-social media.
Mm-hmm.
It's the beginnings of the internet. Like, we've had enough of the internet to know what it is. Mm-hmm. But we're still not familiar with what, as a corporation, what is the internet for us? What?
Yeah.
And the same thing with graphic design, because so much of the internet is graphic design. Literally, it's a computer describing in ones and zeros to another computer what a picture looks like, and then it recreates the picture. I mean, that's the basic boiled down version of what the internet is, or at least how I explain it to old people when I used to sell cell phones. But
it's a series of tubes. Come on.
Yeah. But you had to, I imagine it was a hard place to find a job back then, because they didn't know who they needed or what they needed.
Yeah, and it was definitely a situation where, you know, you're 22, you're thrust out into the world, and you're kind of like, oh, it doesn't just all happen for you. Like, you kind of have to go on Craigslist and look for jobs. So I went on Craigslist and I looked for jobs, and I took the first job that I could get, which was an administrative sort of position at a nonprofit. And that's where I began my accidental daytime career that funds my artistic lifestyle.
So are you still working in the nonprofit sphere, or are you, because I know you're a production manager at Asinia, which I don't know what it is.
Yeah, I am, thank God, not working at that nonprofit anymore, but I was for 12 years of my life.
What?
Yeah. Hey. Don't do that.
I was with the same company for 15 years.
No, don't.
Don't
do that is my advice to the children, especially in a nonprofit. Do not do that. Do not give that to them. They will never give it back to you.
Company will never love you as much as you love them.
Oh, Lord, no. And there's a lot to be said about working in nonprofit. That's probably for another day. But it did then lead me down my path.
This is the podcast about day jobs. So this is that day. But no, let's talk about the a senior that you work at is an e-commerce company, which I still don't know what that is. Like,
I'm like a year and a half in, and I still every day I'm like, all right, guys, you've hit the limit of what I understand today. But I don't need to be an e-commerce expert. I don't need to be a logistics expert. I am a project manager. And that is what I developed through my time in such nonprofit that we don't do or do not need to speak more of. And it's what I do today. And I honestly think it's been a very reciprocal relationship between what I do during the day with a company versus what I do as far as comics publishing is concerned. And I think both of those skills have gone back and forth quite a bit. And it's been, you know, pretty beneficial all around as far as developing those skill sets.
I gotta imagine working in corporate America, doing the, like, here's our day-to-day operational managing of whatever your business is. There has to be somebody that orders the boxes, that have to keep the inventory and stuff like that. And that's incredibly important in your business, where you're creating a product, selling it, and shipping it to people.
Oh, yes. My entire room here is just the stuff that I give out to people and how I get it to them.
Oh, I've had plenty of nights with the bands that I've worked with over the years, going stuffing buttons and pins into Ziploc baggies and organizing that. I mean, I do it like my day job. The reason I have 3 months off is because I'm, you guys had them in Philadelphia, duck boats. Do you know what a duck
boat is? Oh, yeah. We famously had a duck boat incident in Philadelphia.
Yes, you did. And so did we in Boston.
We don't see many of them anymore.
We still have them in Boston, so I'm a narrator for them. Somebody else drives around, and I just talk.
Nice.
Perfect job for me, right? But I drive around Boston, and a World War II replica amphibious vehicle drives around the city of Boston and goes into the Charles River. And the Charles River is frozen during this time of the year, so we can't do that.
That's pretty nice, though.
My character is a ukulele punk rocker. Everyone has characters about their new character.
I never thought about it, that you have like a persona for your duck.
I don't know if
tour.
Other companies do. Ours, Boston Duck Tours, pushes the character persona because we want to be comedic. We want to be humorous.
Why not?
75% history, 25% humor. My numbers are definitely not that.
They're aspirational, okay?
The aspirational would be if I knew more history, and I don't. I know enough history just so I can tell my jokes. There's definitely points where, like, you know, this is a history tour, not a comedy tour. And it's like, look, I'm writing comedy. People are having fun. Give me grief when they start complaining, okay? Anyway.
Exactly. But, they have the internet.
So part of, like, what I wanted to bring to this character as a born and raised punk rock kid and a DIY guy was to bring punk rock merch to my character. So I have punk rock album cover parodies that have been turned into with ducks and stuff. Like I have the London Calling album. That's a duck smashing the bass instead of Paul Simon.
Yes.
Like, yes. Yeah. Like I got Bad Brains, Band in DC. But it's a reggae rubber ducky instead of the Capitol Bill. Like there's Social Distortion skeleton is a duck skeleton. So I do trivia and I give out these stickers to guests that are these punk rock album covers that I joke, like, here's my first album cover, here's my third, here's the skeleton, scary skeleton duck. And because I wanted to bring that atmosphere. So I still, even to this day, every couple of weeks have to just pull out the big bags of stickers and sort them and put them like here's and then put them all in my little baggies and make sure that they're all accounted for and that the merch packs are all set. And it's I'm spending my own money on these things, by the way. Like, this is, I make a good amount of
tax deductible money, though.
Well, this is my first.
I love talking about comics taxes.
I don't think I have enough for to exceed the standard deduction.
Yeah, we,
I'm getting the W-2 from the company. So that makes a big difference. Yeah, you're already owning your own company. So yeah, you have much more stringent.
Yeah, I get that sweet Schedule C going. And it was as soon as we started running Kickstarter campaigns and we would get like a 1099 from them, I'm like, oh man, you're documenting this income.
Curses you, Kickstarter. And your government policies of.
But then it opened up
what they're supposed to do.
The wide, wonderful world of deductions to me, which, oh, I love a deduction.
I think I have just a violent reaction to the word deductions because I listened to open mic comedians that started 1 year in. You're like, you're not making money. Why are you deducting tax for your...
No, the IRS will warn you. Yeah, they'll warn you if you report a loss too many years in a row. They're like, careful now. This is a hobby. We're going to come get you.
I've had 2 years where I've claimed... entertainment as a career, and both of them was lost years, and I was like, I got three more of these before I am not allowed to do it anymore. Let me back off.
I will say it completely made me understand in a new light the producers. I was like, oh, I get it now. You operate at just enough of a loss, it works out fantastically. Not that that's the goal. Would love more income.
All right. Let's get to the Weird Al. How did you become the webmaster for Weird Al Yankovic? Like, I was a big fan, and there's no way I could... Like, I grew up in a world where I knew television was made. I grew up in a world where I knew comedian was a profession, that actors were professions. Like, these... I have a heart... Like, one of my other podcast friends, Ken Reed, amazing podcast called TV Guidance Counselor Podcast, where he owns every edition of TV Guide. Him and his guests go pick an edition, they go through it. It's amazing. Amazingly interesting stuff. But one of the questions he often asked his guests was always, when did you realize that TV was made? That it was made? And I was like, I don't know if there was ever a time where I didn't remember. Like, I don't remember having that violent reaction, like, Santa's not real. I hope your kids aren't listening to the podcast, people. Anyway, I put explicit for a reason. Anyway, but I always knew that TV was made. I always knew that the people on my TV are actors.
Yes.
And that's a job. So I don't have, so I knew I could always get into this, but I also couldn't see myself ever knowing Weird Al Yankovic. Like I've met celebrities.
Neither did I for a long time in my life.
So how did you?
So I would say first, the first distinction is I was not the webmaster of Weird Al's website. That's actually Weird Al's drummer does that.
I'm sorry. Yeah. How did you get involved with the Weird Al fan club? That's where I was meaning to go.
Yes. So
I say a lot of words. So
I would love the clout. I would love the clout of saying when I was 13, I was the webmaster of Weird Al's website, but I cannot. But yeah, I would say that, and in my book, I go into it quite a bit too, where, I discovered Weird Al at around the same age that a lot of people do. You know, you're like 13 years old. It was around when Running with Scissors came out, which had The Saga Begins on it, which was also foundational, canon building material for young Kelly, because I was also obsessed with Star Wars and those movies when I was a kid.
And The Saga Begins gives the entire plot of all of Star Wars away. Nobody cared. Nobody's like, hey, whoa, Weird Al Spurs. Like, no, this song's great. You like it.
Oh, and what's kind of amazing about it, too, is he made sure that he released that album and that song as close to the movie coming out as possible, which means that he needed that in the can, like, months before it was coming out. So what he did is he actually just went on, RCC, is that it? All the web forums that existed at the time, all of those things, to tease out every bit of storyline information that he could, put it together into a song, and only had to make tiny, tiny revisions by the time that the movie actually came out so that he could release it right when the movie was ready.
Yeah. And today in 2024, that's easy to do. I could do it here in this room and have it done in a couple hours.
He was grinding it out.
In 1998, that was nearly impossible. Like, you're talking about.
No, it's a Herculean task. Yeah. Extremely well-protected movie when it was coming out. So, yes, Herculean task to do that. So, all of this to say, I was obsessed. As soon as I found out who Weird Al was, I was losing my fucking mind. And I was then trolling the entire internet for any information that I could find on him. And, this was a time when, to me, the internet felt finite. Like, there was, you could Google search and be like, there's the 6 results that come up for Weird Al, the end. And you could read all of it. Yeah.
There was a time where things weren't Googleable. There was also a time where it wasn't Google.
Yeah, Google.
That time, there was, like, we're talking, like, Phantom Menace came out in 1999.
Which this is when I'm prowling around looking for everything I could. Yeah. Yeah.
Google was, I don't think Google was around in 2001.
Yahoo. I was
using AOL. So
yeah, I was all over Yahoo for sure. So then, reading different there were maybe a couple big fan sites at the time. And I was then, putting two and two together that as a 13-year-old girl in the year 2000, how else you express your deep abiding passion for something other than to build a website about it? And that was a form of creative expression that me and my friends pursued quite a bit. So I got a book on how to learn HTML in a weekend. It took me more than a weekend, but it was a straight up book with a CD-ROM in it. And I built a website. And that was, of course, the early fledgling beginnings of my graphic design career, all textured backgrounds and everything included. And it just went from there. And, you kind of just then connect with the other people doing the extremely niche thing that you are doing. And there were different Yahoo groups and stuff where you could chat with strangers. And one thing leads to another. And then people know that you're a Weird Al fan for the whole rest of your life.
My first AOL screen name was, Pez X Plaid, because I liked the color plaid and I collected Pez dispensers. That was my identity for a long time. It's just like, there's Dennis wearing plaid and eating Pez candy.
Yep. Email was a Weird Al reference for a long time.
That's interesting, too, because it's like, when I started out, we didn't use our name on the internet. I mean, mm-hmm. There's still a lot of anonymity on the internet now, but it's so much more acceptable and preferred that people's online names be some semblance of their real names. The same thing with Twitter. Like Twitter, you know, the amount of people that have their real names is their Twitter handles, which makes so much sense. And then like the people that don't have their real name, that have something like that's not even like a, like granted my Twitter, you know, my social media handles are Dead Air Dennis. It's my radio name. It was a name that I used in the radio industry. And like for me to hide what my identity was seems more sketchy now than it was back in the '90s, where it was like, hey, don't put your name on the internet. Like,
but we're also people that were coming up on the internet as children.
Yeah.
As like minors.
You're right on that. But it's also a matter of like, it was more, the names were more expressive to who and what.
Yes, it was. And you changed them all the time, depending on what you were into, you know, and you had to add your X's if you wanted them to look edgy and all that stuff.
All right, so creating the Weird Al, I'm sorry I didn't get to read the book. I left it in Boston. I really wanted to be able to read it and like, I get to read about you.
Oh, you'll learn so much more.
So creating the is the website still, your Weird Al fan site still up? Is it?
No, it is very much a product of the Wayback Machine now. So you can certainly look it up. And I have some, you know, little snippets of it in the book, but it is gone the way of the dinosaurs of the internet. And I moved on to other things in my life. But that's also part of what the book goes into, is that, you know, Weird Al was like such a humongous part of my life and my consciousness for such a long time that, you know, things come and go as they naturally do. And there was a point in my life where it all sort of faded and other things took priority. And then at a certain point in my 20s, I was starting to be like, you know, it was really fun and nostalgic and what I should maybe make a comic about someday, since I'm very into memoir comics, is I was like, I should just get into this whole Weird Al experience. But that then also made me tap back in to what was going on in the Weird Al fandom, since I had just kind of, you know, lost touch with it for several years. And that was the stage that Weird Al, I think, was starting to become like legend status. And in a more universal way, because I think for a very long time, he was very much, you know, like for his audience. But now you can't go anywhere and not have Weird Al guesting on something or doing a voice for something, or somebody's talking about how they grew up listening to his albums. And he's, I think, very rightfully so, earned this enormity of social cachet at this stage of his career. So getting back into it at that stage and then getting to kind of witness the scale at which the scene was at was a mind fuck.
Yeah, and it's interesting that he became the legendary status at the end of his career, because he doesn't make records anymore. Like, he finished his contractually obligated deal with the record label. It's like, yep, this is the last record I'm putting out under this label. It's not the last record I'll ever put out, but it's the last one I'm going to put out with them. And we'll see what he does. Like, he still hasn't really, you know,
Yeah, he really, I don't like to say that he rests on his laurels now. I think he gets to do what he likes on his laurels at this point.
And he got to the point where the people that were influenced by his music have finally become the ones that are making media. It's similar to where like the Renaissance, the film Renaissance of the mid-90s, where you had all these kids who grew up with the 70s auteur movement in film. They now get to make films.
Yep.
Same thing happened with Star Wars. All the people that grew up watching Star Wars are the ones who Dave Filoni and Jon Favreau are great examples of people who grew up on Star Wars.
Yep.
Who now get to make Star Wars.
Totally. You know, like
Tim Gunn. Right? Guardians of the Galaxy.
James Gunn. Tim so Gunn is the fashion guy.
Fashion. Yes. He's one of the Queer Eye guys, but. James Gunn is an amazing filmmaker because he grew up watching amazing films, and now he gets to create the story, the intricate and amazingly nuanced and very smart and well thought out and well plotted stories with characters that, and then he also grew up in trauma films. So all these amazing stories do also have dick and ball jokes that are so grossly offensive and dirty. But that's the world he grew up in. He gets to do all
and
that.
And that's very true in comics and animation right now, too. Like, you get shows like Steven Universe that is so clearly influenced by all the same stuff that I grew up watching. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, I see you people of the same age. I see that we all read the same things and watched the same things. And now you're making media with us in mind. Like, this is awesome.
Seth MacFarlane. Yeah, we get it. You grew up in the 80s. Okay. All your references are of a very specific time point, Seth.
No one cares about Gen X. Come on.
Oh, don't get me started on how much people hate us. Every time I mention it at an open mic, somebody's going to come up and start. Whenever I hear people doing boomer and millennial jokes, and I was like, I'm Gen X. They're like, nobody cares. I'm like,
no, truly no one cares.
We're the ones that are not caring.
As a geriatric millennial, I also firmly understand. No one cares about us anymore.
So I don't want you to give away the book or the comics in it, but was there, did you have to go back and find certain things to remind yourself of that time? Like,
you don't even know the amount of research that I had to do for this book.
Research your own life?
Yes. No, truly. And it's something that we talk about a lot when asked about making memoir comics, is that there's quite a bit of editing and fictionalization that needs to happen. Because number one, I think if you're making a memoir comic, you need to understand that you as a main character are not inherently interesting or likable. So you need to figure out how do you make yourself compelling and how do you want yourself to come across to readers? So you really need to focus more on what kind of a story are you telling with you as the central character and your life as the backdrop, and then use all of the facts in the most utilitarian way possible. But I still had to, you know, like timeline things out, find old emails, look up the original source code of my website so I could look at it and see what I actually wrote on there.
I can imagine that's like watching you look at old HTML is like watching people read The Matrix.
Oh my God. Yeah. 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 No, everyone of my age group knows way more HTML than you would imagine because we were all building fan sites.
Well, and also MySpace was HTML.
Oh, totally. And LiveJournal, everything required you to just know basic HTML. So yeah, there was a lot of research that went into it, a lot of plotting out how I was going to present these events, like these milestones throughout this period of my life where I was running this site and Weird Al was very, very central to things. And then I had to kind of come away with, you know, not a lesson or something, but, you know, something I'm trying to communicate to the reader about why I'm sharing this story and why I feel it's significant. And for me,
why did this journey happen? Yeah.
Yeah. Why did this matter? Why was this worthy of, you know, 200 pages of comics? And for me, it was really about, you know, and the whole process of doing this kind of led me to this conclusion. But it was very much about reconnecting with something that was very central and very important and very foundational to me and my sensibilities and the things that I'm into and the people that are around me. And being, you know, at a place in my life where I was so excited to reconnect with it and pull that back into who I am now. So little 13-year-old Kelly's loves and interests are still my interests in my 30s because I acknowledge how much that meant to me and how much I still enjoy those things when I tap back into them. So I think it's really about, you know, just, you know, relishing the things that matter to you and not letting yourself feel embarrassed by it or that, you know, you've outgrown it. Because if something makes you happy, let it make you happy.
That's kind of the moral of everybody who makes anything, really, is if it's making you happy, let it make you happy and don't worry about the other things.
Yeah.
I can only follow that.
Good things will come to you so long as you are being good to yourself, you know?
If I could only practice what I preach, like on that, like if I just didn't sit around in a ball full of anxiety because of the fucking algorithm.
Yeah. And then I would say too, one of the amazing byproducts of making this book is, Weird Al has read it. He owns it. I got to hand him a copy of it after a concert and he jumped up. He shouted my name and he said, "Kelly, I loved your book." And we talked about it for a couple of minutes and he's recognized me ever since whenever I see him at concerts.
I'm getting goosebumps thinking about
it. I know. It was that was a good day. That was a good interaction. But I had never dreamed necessarily that he would, you know, get it, that he would buy actually the original zine copies of it off of my web store under his wife's name. Because I remember,
I was going to ask, do you have Weird Al's credit card number? You don't have to give it out, but do you have Weird Al's credit card number?
I certainly had to pack up the package that included those zines in it. And then I just wondered what happened with that for a few years. But he was like, "Yeah, I have that version." And I got to give him the nicely fully published version that I kickstarted a few years later. And he's done interviews where it's like happily sitting on his back shelf. And I just cry a lot because that's really joyful. And Yeah, and most recently, that's led to me being able to participate in the Illustrated Owl, which is the comics collection that he published through Z2 Comics, which is all comic interpretations of his songs. So that was also a really incredible full circle experience for me, where I got to then illustrate for him a song that mattered a lot to me since I was a little kid.
And which song was it? Because how do you pick? How do you pick?
Yeah.
First off, not only do you have to pick, but how do you get to pick the one that nobody else picked? Like, is there if you and somebody else both picked White Nerdy or whatever it was, is there a draw off? Do you guys like, we're going to draw and he's going to judge which one gets in the book. And if mine don't get in, tough shit.
Well, for the most part, I was really pleased that the majority of the songs that are in that book are originals, too. So it kind of takes that element away of people picking the obvious parodies that everybody knows. So I think it really spoke to a lot of us that Al chose, who he knows are fans, that we would want to do like the oddball one that we are a big fan of that people don't always necessarily think of first. But I was given...
By the way, people don't know, Dare to Be Stupid is a Weird Al original. It's not a parody of a Devo. It's in the style of, but it's an original.
Even though Devo says that Weird Al has written the best Devo song.
Yeah. Mark Spongebob has said, I will hate him for writing a better Devo song than I could ever write.
It's amazing. I was given a list of songs to choose from. So that helped me. But that was then the Sophie's choice to be made of, do I choose like the one that I'm like, oh my God, this would be so awesome to do, but am I really scared of doing it because I don't know if I can do it justice? Or do I just choose the shortest song because I had a really short deadline on it and I knew I could get that one done in time? So I chose the shortest song on the list, but it also happens to be one of my favorite songs, which is Since You've Been Gone from the Bad Hair Day album.
Okay.
And it's an a cappella song that is purely about all of the ways in which Al would rather self-mutilate himself than that is how poorly he feels as if that person were still in his life. So I just got to draw Weird Al getting maimed a lot.
Hey, I love you so much. Let me draw your death.
Let me torture you. And I saw him at a show after I submitted the comic and he got to tell me how much he enjoyed it. And that was very lovely. And he's just an extremely lovely person to be a fan of because he's just the nicest guy. Best guy.
It's great that you got to meet him, that you got to share that art with him. Do you know any of the other artists who are in the book?
Yeah, I do know a handful of them, and others are just other indie cartoonists that I'm familiar with, which is awesome. I'm glad that it was a lot of people who are kind of in my same circles that got to be involved in this type of book.
Have you connected with any of them? Like, do you guys have a secret Illustrated Weird Al meetups where like, let's get together and talk about our Weird Al artworks?
There was allegedly a meetup at the most recent New York Comic Con that the publisher organized where they were like, okay, last minute, who's around? Who can come? And it's like, all right, you guys have fun. So I'm sure some of them had fun. I always hoped that they would maybe do some kind of a book release party somewhere, but pandemic times and all that.
Yeah, they did come out right during then. But so I want to circle back to something that you brought up, and that's storytelling. You did an amazing job describing the purpose of story, because I feel that I do not, as a comedian, say I'm a storyteller, because to me, that's code for unfunny white guys that don't have punchlines. But my comedy is very narrative based, and that's something that I've leaned hard into when I do my writing. Like, I've even tried in past to put Joseph Campbell's 16 points of the hero's journey or whatever it is to just a joke about getting lost. You know, like I try to apply these things to it. And, you know, my bio and website says I'm a writer, but that's that's kind of a lie. But
hey, you put words on paper and somebody else sees it. That's publishing.
I write for a newspaper, and when I say write, what I do is I record a conversation with a friend, have an AI transcribe it, give it to my editor, who proofreads it and spells checks it, and then they mail me a check. It's not writing. It's stealing it from a nonprofit is what I'm doing. But,
well, as we discussed earlier, nonprofits, you're on my shit list. Or at least specific nonprofit, you know what you've done.
So, you know, I have followed story writing because working in film and TV and stuff like that. And there is very specific plot points. There's a really great guy named Seth Worley. I'll give him a plug. writes these little books that are plot point books, because he kind of came up with this idea that if you look, if you watch a movie, you could plot out the entire plot of the movie on a clock, and you'll see things on the clock that correspond with other things. Like in your second act at the 5 o'clock position, it influences what happens at the 10 o'clock position, you know? And it was very interesting thing. So he created these books that have these story clocks for you to be able to,
that's awesome,
story wise by timeline. Like, hey, I know what I want to do in my third act here. Well, I need something here at the second act to set, like,
this is
up.
How I make it have impact later on.
Yeah. And they're literally timed. Like he does essays on like how these movies are timed perfectly. He even did with Middleditch and Schwartz with their improv shows. They were like, even though this is improvised, their story beats still hit at the times they're supposed to hit.
Yeah, people don't know the kind of, you know, sausage making that's going on behind the scenes and preparation in people's heads, but there is stuff guiding this hand along the way.
Yeah, and I have to watch plenty of times when I'm doing like talking with comedians about stuff where they're like, oh, I'm a storyteller. And then I'll listen to them. I was like, no, there's no story here. It's an anecdote. There's no beginning. There's no middle. There's no end. There's no reason for the journey. There's no fundamental change from beginning to end of the character. You just told me about something that happened. It's not a story. And I have an obsessive compulsive disorder that's not fixed by medication, that I have to tell this stuff to the face. But so I've learned pedantically story plotting and stuff like that. And it became something that I had to focus on, because all things that we do, nobody is the natural at. Stephen King didn't write a novel the first time he sat down with a pen and paper. He had to learn story plotting. He had to write shitty stories to get good at writing.
Oh, yeah. You got to mess up a lot before you learn how you do and do not want to do things.
So where did you learn about story plotting?
I think really, and I would say it's still a tip I would give to anybody today, is just read. Mm-hmm. Like, consume the things that you want to make similarly, you know? Like, if there's a creator whose style I really like, I'll just read their stuff ravenously, and I'll try to think about, what is it in this that's compelling me? Like, is it the pacing of their story that's letting me linger and look at the artwork, or really indulge in these descriptions that they're giving? Or is it the style itself that I'm taking away from this? And then there's all these little components that you can then, you know, let into your own process or into your own style. And that will just, I think, naturally influence whatever your storytelling style is. And then honestly, get feedback from people. If something that you've written doesn't make sense, it's not going to make sense to anybody but you. So figure out what it is that you need to add in there that's either contextual or environmental or, you know, motivationally, that people need to understand to connect with your work in the way that you want them to connect with it. And I think just always being really centrally minded of, what am I trying to communicate? What do I want somebody to leave with after they've consumed or experienced this thing that I've presented to them? And then I think, you know, just trust your own voice and let that be what takes you through it. And you're not going to make a perfect thing. No one will care. And it's going to be fine. You're going to have made the thing. It's going to be effective. And then the next time you make a thing, you'll have learned something from that. And you'll just keep making better and better stuff as you go.
That is great advice. Overall, in general, when it comes to making art, it's like, hey,
just do it.
The hardest part is the starting. Yeah, I do it to myself every time, staring at the blank page.
Mm-hmm.
Staring at that blank page, cursor blinking, or just looking at the lines on a rule.
It is the worst part of the phase. It's like, you just got to start something. Write the middle line of this piece of dialogue that you're thinking about. Do whatever it is that will just get the wheels greased, and then be like, all right, wait, no, I got to organize my thoughts and go back to the beginning. But then you're in it. Then you've gotten the momentum going.
All right, and now let's go back. I'm sorry, I forgot your Dirty Diamonds partner's name.
Claire.
Okay. You and Claire, when you guys started forming Dirty Diamond, what was the process to creating a official business? And also, what artists, what went into deciding which artists you were going to bring onto, like, is it fair to call, like, what is Dirty Diamond? Is it fair to call it a label? Is it a publishing company? Like, what's the actual title of the company?
Yeah, we consider it our anthology series. It's we sometimes get considered a collective. I wouldn't say that. We sometimes get considered publishers. I wouldn't necessarily say we're that. But that it's at the very least this anthology project that we've done. And I think it's very much just the mission, too, of wanting to create a place for women cartoonists to be able to have their comic scene. So when we first made it, we were very much it was a very petty reaction to not seeing the books that we wanted to see. And we were like, all right, if these dumbos can do it, so can we.
Look, hatred is a really great motivator.
Especially because this was formed by four women living in Philadelphia. You know that pettiness was at the core. But again, it was four of us who were all cartoonist friends. We were sitting in a room and we were shooting the shit about what it is that we would like to do. And we were like, oh, why don't the four of us just make this book together? And it was as simple as that. We just decided, let's all make a four-page comic around a central theme, one that was very near and dear to us, alcohol. And let's photocopy it.
Spoken like 20-something old white girls. Let's do
exactly. Woo. And you know, you print it on the work photocopier after hours. Thank you, day job. You fold and staple it on each other's floors.
One of the later questions is going to be, what resources from work have you stolen for the comic books?
Oh,
but I also that would have been too incriminating.
Well, item number one would be time. It's what I've stolen. I've run entire Kickstarter campaigns from my work desk. But yeah, and then suddenly we had a thing that we could put on a table and put in front of people at a zine fest, and thus began our prestigious publishing career. And then from there, yeah, it was just about, you know, soliciting people online just to be like, did you like this? Would you like to make something like this? Come join the next volume. And then they just got bigger and bigger over time, and now they're hard to ship to Canada.
Look, you're doing a great job at what we in the comedy industry like to call callbacks. I just want you to have that compliment. You have a very...
That's storytelling, baby.
I'm terrible at callbacks. My jokes don't have callbacks. They're just like, here's where it begins, here's where it ends, and this is the crazy stuff that happens in the middle. I'm not referencing... Look, you don't need to take notes to be able to get a joke later on, okay? I'm just going to keep rolling through with new ones.
It's almost intentional. Which also helps that, you know, I was a student of a comedy music master for a long time in my life, so I have thought about a lot of these things too, which has influenced, even if I wasn't thinking about it at the time, the way I tell stories.
Well, I mean, also, I have to pay you that compliment because I'm so used to people not being that self-aware or just have that nuanced perspective of what goes into things. Like, one of the things that we talk about in comedy a lot when it comes to storytelling is we reference a comedian named Christopher Titus. He had a TV show on Fox in the 90s called Titus. He's an amazing comedian. And he is, to the truest degree, a storyteller. But he has said in his own writing that what he does is he writes out his story, and then every line of the story is a setup, and he writes a punchline for it. And you listen to his things, and you don't realize how many jokes are in his stories until you sit down and count his laughs per minute. His laughs per minute are off the charts, everything, but it's all streamed together in a great narrative, and you don't notice the structure. And that's other people, even comedians that are like, are fans of this stuff, don't realize it because they don't take that kind of time to learn from what they're watching. They could just watch it and they gather.
Exactly, yeah. When you start to really peer behind the curtain and be like, wait a minute, he was thinking about this the whole time. And then you start to really understand the genius of it and you're like, oh, but then I could do that too. Like, I could just be that thoughtful in my process. And suddenly, you know, if somebody sees the deliberate action that I've done in the back end, great, but they don't have to. They just get to enjoy it on the surface, and that's also exactly what I want from them.
And one of the things people never realize when it comes to Weird Al is that all his choruses are different. He never sings the same lines to a chorus. That's one of the things that makes him amazing and brilliant. I've listened to many, many comedic attempting parody artists where, you know, people trying to write parody songs, and that's the first critique I give them, and they're like, why is that a big deal? I was like, because you're creating more. It's more jokes.
Yeah.
It's more perspective. You're putting more work into it. I mean, Weird Al does it. I'm not saying you have to be like Weird Al, but it's like there's a reason why he does that.
Yeah, why not beg, borrow, steal from the masters, you know? And I've heard him talk too about that, where there's a mentality in parody specifically that you're dealing with both the familiar as a comedy element potential, and you're dealing with the unexpected as a comedy element potential. So what you can do with, like, you know, just replacing a word that's similar to what was in the original song, that's inherently funny to people because it's both familiar and unexpected. But I think the really insidious thing that he does that he's talked about is he says one of the first things they'll do is just change the key of the song slightly. Because then suddenly it just sounds a little different. And because it sounds a little different, you're already like, wait a minute, something's up with this. And that just add, like, it's something you would never think about until you put the two things side by side. They're like, oh, he changed the key a little bit. Huh. And there's no purpose to it beyond just like, oh, suddenly this is another thing.
Oh, man, I'm paying attention. I've done that. We'll play as like, all right, is this the weird hour or the original version? We'll have to listen to the intro, like, especially like Smells Like Nirvana.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost the exact same intro. It's just sped up a little more.
Just a little faster.
You just got to notice that little bit different.
And it's enough to throw you off your balance. And then suddenly you're open to something different hitting you. And you're like, oh, I like that. That was fun.
I applaud you for being very self-aware and being, knowing that these things, and the other thing with going back to the music thing was, it also makes the song interesting because songs can be very monotonous. So if you change the lyrics, it's the same thing. Like, you want dynamics in your music. You want, one of my favorite just dumb changes in music is, there's a band called 9 Days. They have a song called Absolutely Parenthetical Story of a Girl. This is the story of a girl.
Yes.
And I love, there's a part at the end where they just, where they're playing and then they're saying the chorus over again. This is the story of a girl who cried a whole river, blah, blah, blah. And there's just a break in it. This is the story of a girl. And it's like half a beat momentary pause changes the dynamic of that song right towards the end, where you're just like starting to fade out of it and not paying attention. It's becoming not, blah, blah, blah. And you're just like, oh yeah, I'm back in it. I'm back in the song again.
And then you know that that's the part of the song that you are dying to get to at karaoke. We're like, this is the line that's going to bring the room together, where everyone's going to be like, this is.
When I'm about to, like, all right, I'm done with the song. I'm about to hit scat. Oh, ah, there it is again. I'm back here.
Like, that's the best part. Yeah.
So do you feel that you learned some of this introspective nature from going to art school?
That's funny. Making me think about the purpose and function of art school in my life. I don't know. I feel like a lot of art school is very, there's a lot of like technical training involved in it. Like, you go to drawing class and you learn how to draw and you learn how to like see things differently so you can learn how to draw. But I think because of that, you end up having to imbue a lot of that. And when you're starting to have to, you know, like actually make images that aren't just, you know, the model in front of you, you're having to craft an image, you have to start being like, okay, how am I putting these pieces together myself? So there is somewhat of like a self-driven element to art classes, I would say. And I think that then means it's you get as much as you give. So it could be that because I come from a perspective where I really enjoy storytelling, I got a lot of things out of what I was doing to inform my storytelling. But I don't know if that's a universal experience necessarily. Some people, I think, you know, really enjoy making a static image and allowing people to interpret it in 100 different ways. And I'm very much like, I am telling a story. If you want to connect to it in different ways, that's fine. But it is a story with a beginning, middle, and end.
Well, the reason I ask that is because I think about it, I'm literally sitting across the street from my art magnet high school that I went to. Again, I went to that school because I lived across the street, not because I got accepted into any of the art programs. But I was still involved with things. Like, I was heavily involved with theater. And I can tell you, the reason I'm sitting right here having a conversation with you is 100% because of my theater program and my theater teacher and the tech theater teacher.
Nice.
It influenced me to the knowing that I could be doing the things that I went off and did after high school. But I was also, you know, I had to take an art class. And we had these amazingly talented art teachers that were teaching kids every day. Their curriculum was art in addition to their general studies. And I remember one day in this art class, we're dumb. We're just the regular kids taking art class. We're not like special little molded little snowflake soon to be out in the world running the world in artists. Like, we're just dumb kids having to do this, right? And I remember Farrell Maddox, who's the name of this teacher, did a lot of like, he's just teaching an art class, but all at the same time, he's trying to get you to think openly about art and about what you are creating.
Yeah.
So I remember just vaguely him doing that. And I remember talking to, you know, dealing with the other teachers and stuff. And they always seem to have while they're like, even my friends talking to my friends who are in the art program and stuff, they are like, oh, well, the I have to do this. Like, listening to them talk about their own artwork retrospectively. And I'm like, wow, that's a lot of big words for a 10th grader. Like, where did you figure this out? This is what you're teaching us. So I would imagine maybe that's regular or a shared experience amongst all art school students or people. I don't know. I feel like most visual artists, people are the ones who have the most well-rounded introspective of people that I've met. Maybe. I don't know. Maybe I'm projecting.
It could be too, because I mean, when you go to art school and college, at the very least, you definitely get into the critique cycle, which is where you'll usually have to, you know, present something that you've made to the class, and you just open yourself up to feedback from anyone and everyone. So when you're suddenly having to talk about your work more, you suddenly start to have to think about your work more. And sometimes you'll put something up and somebody will ask a question about it or make a comment, and you'll be like, yeah, that doesn't resonate with me at all, which means that I probably didn't put a lot of thought into this. So then you start to put more thought into it. And then when people do get to, you know, picking up on those things that you deliberately left for them, those little Easter eggs or what have you, that then makes it feel more meaningful. So maybe that experience did, in a more insidious way, influence the way that I think about and make art. But yeah, it's a great environment to get to experience. And I would say too, one of the things I really liked about the choice I made for the kind of art school I went to is because I was taking it with other people in my BA program, which also meant that I was taking it with everybody else who was just taking their art credit. So I was taking art classes with people who were like, oh yeah, I'm like a finance major or a geology major or whatever. And they're like, I chose to do painting because of all the art options, I thought painting would be the most fun. And they were some of the best people that I got to interact with in those environments. So I was also very happy that my choice worked out, that I was getting to do and experience and talk about art with people who came from all those different perspectives. And it wasn't just for the intention of making art, it was also for the enjoyment of making art. And I think the further that I get into my life, more or less, the more I appreciate that I've been able to make really self-indulgent projects. And one of the ways that I've been able to do that is because my art does not fund my life. My work life funds my ability to do that in the way that I want to do that.
That's what this podcast is about. The things that we do have to do during the day to support what we want to do at night. But speaking of the enjoyment of art, are you even able to enjoy creating art just for fun? I mean, one of the problems I have is that everything entertainment-based has to be monetized or has to be part of my comedy or entertainment.
That is a hard mentality to grapple with because, you know, especially because we have this habit of going to comic shows, you want to have something new to put on the table and to give out to people. And whether you sell, you know, 5 of them or 50 of them, you want somebody to want it. You want somebody to resonate with it. And, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, adding a lot to the bank account, but I think it's more about, you know, having that ability to connect with people in some way. But it means that you need to spend money producing the thing, getting to the place where you can give them the thing, and money then has to come into the equation. So,
I'm more concerned with, like, you started drawing for fun. It was a thing that you did in your spare time. It was a thing that brought you enjoyment. Now art is so much part of you. So much part of your life and your daily routine. Can you even sit back and just go when you're in your downtime, go, I'm just going to go make a painting and then not show it to anybody? Can you create art that is just for you, that you don't have to sell, that you don't have to display to people, that you don't have to put on social media and hope that somebody likes it so that you know that your account will be favored in the algorithm to show the things that are important for you to show people on social media?
Yeah.
You can see I'm going in a downward spiral already in my own brain.
Like, yeah, because I think we would both have the same reaction, which is no, it's hard to make things that are purely for yourself. And I would say that, like, maybe the closest I get to that is just recently even. There's this annual event called Hourly Comic Day. It's always on February 1st. And the only rule is that for every hour that you're awake, you draw a comic. So if you wake up 8 o'clock, draw a little comic. You are awake until 11 p.m., draw a comic for every single one of those hours. And then all you do with it is you just post it online, and then you get to read all these people's days. And it's just like a really nice way to connect with people. And it was actually one of the ways that my friend Claire and I first got back into comics, was just how accessible that was and how enjoyable that seemed to be. So I just got to do that. And I was purely like, all right, I'm going to take my time. I'm not going to finish it on time. I'm going to put it up on Instagram whenever it's done. And this was purely for me. I don't care if anyone found this entertaining. I had a good time doing it. It's hopefully bonus if other people enjoy it and engage with it. But I would say primarily, I'm just happy that I did it. And it helps me to feel like I still am in my practice. I'm still productive. I can still grind that out in a day or so. And then, yeah. It would be, yeah, I mean, I guess I would have to grapple with myself in a quiet space to see if there was art that I wanted to just be making for myself that I'm not making. But right now, I think because I like to make comics, one of the key elements, the storytelling piece, requires an audience. So I think that's part of the exchange that I am looking for in telling a story.
Well, as somebody for me as who works in the movies, TV, films as well, it took a long time for me to be able to watch a movie without analyzing every single frame.
Yeah, no, that can be hard. I definitely do just get to like read comics and enjoy them purely and not be like, oh my God, how did this person do this? How did they get this book deal? How did they do all that? Like, I don't go down that rabbit hole unless I'm deliberately trying to tease that information out of it. I'll just purely be like, oh, I'm going to read this book that I bought 2 years ago today, finally. And then I just really enjoy that. And I get to say hi to the person who made it and tell them they did a good job.
Yeah, sometimes it's hard to for us,
but it can be very hard to turn it off for sure.
It's hard to turn it off. Like I was just saying, I was saying to my friend who was hosting trivia, I was talking about back when I was hosting trivia. I didn't host trivia because I like trivia. I definitely was not hosting trivia because I'm smart. Hell, I told teams, when you hear me read the question, that's the first time I've read that question, right? Like. I'm here reading the questions because I'm not capable of answering the question, right? And we're talking about, like, to me, my trivia shows was a comedy show. Trivia is just a reason for me to make jokes. I'm going around and I'm talking to tables. I'm making jokes. I'm you know, being funny at every moment.
Yeah, and that's enriching you, you know?
And he was saying, like, yeah, man, sometimes I just want to host trivia and not be on. I'm like, I'm never off. That's the problem.
Yeah, you're like, I like to be on. On is the point.
Yeah. But there is times where I have to learn to turn it off, just be palatable, or just because I need my own time to just be a person. And that is, like, for me, being on is this, the animation. Telling, always constantly having a joke. I'm sure for you, being on is creating art.
Is grinding it out, yeah.
Yeah, and I gotta imagine sometimes it's hard for you to just, like, you know what? I want to just go back and just draw something that is not going to become some kind of work later on. That's not going to become more than just me doodling.
And I guess the more I'm marinating on this, I think because I don't have to rely on my comics and my artwork sustaining like my ability to live, it means that even the stuff, even if everything that I'm making eventually gets put on paper, gets put on a table, puts a dollar tag on it, it's still all stuff that I want to be making. I'm never making something that is, you know, purely because I need to do it, or rarely so.
And there's people out there listening to this podcast that needed to hear that sentence from you.
Yeah.
So what is in the works for Dirty Diamonds right now? Can we get a preview of what's coming out next, or what you just released recently for the people who are just discovering you and your comics?
Yeah, so Dirty Diamonds is an interesting question. In 2020, we were aiming to publish the 10th and final installment of that anthology series, and the theme of the book was death, very rightfully so. And then suddenly...
End this whole series with death.
Yeah, we wanted to kill it. But then, very ironically, a global pandemic happened. So it took us about 2 years... Huh? Yeah, don't worry about it. It's over now. So it took us about 2 years to finally like fully release that book. And the intention when we were ending the series was always to figure out what the new version of Dirty Diamonds would be, whether it was another kind of publication, did it take a completely different form? who knows? So now that we've finally gotten to fully bring, you know, this poor book into the world, we're now finally getting to go on this journey of figuring out what it is that kind of, in the same way that we were sparked to inspiration and into action when we first made that book, what is that right now that we feel like we should be doing instead? So the short answer to your question is we're doing some recon and figuring out what should be the next step for Dirty Diamonds. And in the meantime, we're also, you know, just re-exposing ourselves into the convention circuit, since that really only fully came back last year. We're trying to get into new cities places.
I was definitely the only person at MICE that was not wearing a mask, because I was like, I didn't know this was a mask event. There was definitely a couple of ushers that were like, excuse me, and I just keep walking. I am not anti-mask, but I have gotten to a point where I'm like,
I need a minute.
I'm done with masks. If you don't want to let me in because I'm not wearing a mask, I'm not going to put up a fight. I'm going to be like, all right, cool, fine.
I saw a fight happen.
If I'm leaving unmasked because you don't want me in without a mask, that's fine. But if somebody is going to be like, fuck you, I'm going to, this is America, I'm going to drag them out by their ears. I'm going to be like, no.
Watch it happen.
I'm pro-masked. But also not going to wear masks.
I like masks for three reasons. One, at a comic show, it means that I don't have to constantly be smiling, and your face hurts so much when you've been smiling for 8 hours straight at people. You can just relax the muscles for a few hours. Two, I love wearing a mask on public transportation because it's so fucking nasty, and I don't get colds as often as I used to when I used to get sneezed on every other day. And three, when I'm breaking out and I don't have to put any makeup on to be in public, I can just be like, oh no, I'm gonna wear a mask today.
Yeah, fair enough. And but also, you don't wear glasses.
I do not wear glasses. No, I do not have to deal with that problem. My husband, for sure, had that struggle from day one.
Yeah, the fogging up of glasses is a big reason for hating masks. Let's.
Oh yes, I fully understand the additional struggle there.
And I'm also mask pedantic enough to be like, the easy fix for hogging, put your nose out. Then that defeats the purpose of the mask.
That is the thing we're trying to cover up, sir.
I watched a guy all last night at this brewery trivia contest, nose out the entire time. I'm like, what are you still doing? What are you doing? Why is it still a conversation that nose has to be in the mask?
I saw somebody take their mask off to cough.
Oh, the amount of people. Yeah, I've seen that where they pull their mask down to sneeze, which.
Yep.
To sneeze
openly, where it's like, have we not even learned the elbow technique by now? 5-year-olds do it.
Sneezing in a mask does suck. It's the worst. It's gross.
Oh, yeah. It's nasty, but you're like, it's my own nast, so I'll deal with it, you know?
I had, like, pre-pandemic, I definitely did one of those, like, achoo, into my shirt, and then just went, oh, why did I do that? Like, that was the first time I did that, and then the last time I did that. And sneezing in mask is that constantly. But, yeah.
Like, well, also, I want people to have snot all over their face than in my lungs.
Yeah, and which is the thing, I'm a believer in the masks that are preventative. Masks are strictly preventative, not defensive.
Yeah, for me, it's like, I know I'm going to be in a situation where this is going to get dicey, and I want to continue to live my life beyond this week, or I know I need to be around people who need me to be doing this right now.
Again, that's probably the difference to us, is that you want to live and I'm a comedian who constantly has suicidal ideology. So, you know, there's again to that.
Hey, I fully subscribe to everyone wants to be dead. No one wants to die.
It's a lot of rest being dead. So, all right. So what else with your comics, what in your comic industry right now, what else is going on and where can people find all of your artwork?
Yeah, me, myself, and I am also still working on my own comics. I came out with one last year that was another memoir. It's a travelogue about a trip I took to Austria with my mom, which is where her side of the family is from. So that's a whole, like, relationship-based story with a bunch of pretty drawings of mountains. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of my getting back into the swing of things comic. And now I'm trying to put out a few new things this year. I'm continuing a series of comics about cats, because I grew up not only in a nerd household, but in a crazy cat lady household. Because my mother is a veterinarian, which meant that we said no to any animal, or we did not say no to any animal that crossed our path. So I have lots of fun stories about that. I'm trying to get back into the swing of that with a few new cute stories. So hopefully that's coming out in the next couple of months. And then I'm also working on a long form fictional thriller that very much takes notes from what I consider to be high art, which is Lifetime movies. So I'm trying to make my version of a Lifetime movie series.
You're making your version of a lady from the big city goes back to her small hometown and falls in love with the unlikeliest person.
Now, see, and I could go on true diatribes about this. That is the Hallmark movie structure. Lifetime is murders.
Okay, yeah, well,
melodramatic murders.
Be honest. Here's the insight of what that what the joke I was just trying to create in my own head was. Do I go down two roofs? Do I do the Hallmark romantic comedy thing? Or do I do Lifetime is the network that does nothing but murder and rape women? And I didn't want to say
murder
rape
and
on this
rape,
podcast.
Baby. That's what we're after. Kidnapping babies.
I just brought the room down to total darkness where people who are listening to the podcast had to bring the lights in their room a little bit when I was talking about my own suicide ideology. I wanted to keep the R word rape out of the podcast, but now you forced me. You forced my hand there, Kelly.
But you know what? We are also people who grew up in the era of SVU, so it is very much in our brains as comedy at all times.
And we both grew up in big cities where you gotta be on heads on a swivel, heads on a swivel.
And you know what? If you want to talk more about films that follow a clock-based storytelling structure, I have 100,000 things to say about the structure of a Lifetime movie. Which is why I think I've studied them accidentally for too long. I need to suddenly make my own.
Excellent. Well, I'm looking forward to it. And where can people find all of those books? Which, by the way, you didn't mention the Dr. Seuss parody book, All the Things You
Oh,
Learned.
Yeah.
Where can people find all of those books?
You can find me online at kellyphillips.net or on social media anywhere at Kelly P Comics, and you will be able to find links and all that jazz to my store, and you'll see updates about when I'm going to events, hopefully near you.
Awesome. And final question, on a scale of 1 to 10, how mad are you at the person that has kellyphillips.com? Because they're probably a realtor and they're not interesting.
I think I did look that up once upon a time, and at the time that I was getting my website domain, I was like, .net is so much sexier. We're not even mad.
Excellent. Kelly, you've been an absolute guest. It was so good to hear your life story. I'm glad we were able to get this connection, even without the fact that I meant to read your book and then left it 400 miles away.
Well, now you have homework.
I will. As soon as I get back to Boston, it's getting cracked open.
Hell yeah. Awesome. Love it.
This has been great. Thanks.
Thanks so much for having me.